Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
So thanks for coming this evening. So Robert Wiss is the author of The Man Who Built the Sierra Club, A Life of David Brower, published by Columbia University Press. And Robert Wiss has been a journalist for over 40 years, serving as a writer and editor at the Providence Journal, where he covered energy, environment, and business, and where he was a three-time Pulitzer Prize nominee. He has also written for the New York Times, Boston Globe, and many other papers, magazines, and online publications. And he has created a blog called A Coal Black Sky, where he writes about St. Louis's ongoing efforts to combat air pollution. He's also taught journalism for over 30 years now at a variety of universities, but now and for I think about the last 13 years at the University of Connecticut. And here he is particularly known for his teaching about environmental journalism, digital journalism, and on working on projects which help scientists connect and share their knowledge and research with the public. His book, The Man Who Built the Sierra Club, is the product of many years of research, not only on David Brower, but also on others active in the Sierra Club and many other environmentalists. And he's produced a book about a pivotal figure who, with others, moved the Sierra Club in the post-war era from a gentleman's hiking and nature appreciation group, largely, to the political activist organization it eventually became. Brower's work was international in scope, and though he had many successes, Mr. Wiss is not shy about discussing his shortcomings. His account of Brower's life is also an account of the times in which he lived and a story of the evolution of the environmental movement. So today he will give a talk, and as you can see, he's got some images for us, and then he'll take some questions from the audience. So with that, thank you very much for attending. Please join me in welcoming Robert Wiss.
Thank you. And thank you for coming out. It's August in Seattle. It's the one month you have summer, right? I was just curious, how many people before they came here were familiar with David Brower? That's better than I've been encountering in these talks. And has anybody met David Brower? Did anybody meet David Brower? Okay, great. You all look so young, I wasn't sure if we would find anybody like that in that category. I never met David Brower, but I became very familiar with him in the years I covered the environment, and I always was very interested in seeing if I could find out more about him. Brower, there's a lot that's been written about Brower. Many of you may be familiar with this book by John McPhee, which was really the famous book about Brower, which came out in 1972. There have been a series of like four other books about Brower, and there's been at least two documentaries about Brower. So there has been a fair amount written, plus there's been thousands and thousands of newspaper articles and magazine articles and things like that. So when I signed my contract with Columbia University Press in the summer of 2012, they asked if I could get it done by 2013. I said, well, maybe. Well, then I started doing the research. And to tell you how complicated it was, the book was delivered in the summer of 2015, just last summer. Found the guy a fascinating person, one of really great Americans, one of the most pivotal people in the environmental movement that we're going to find, but complicated. Let me read just what I put in the introduction very briefly. Over the years, David Brower has been called many things: tireless, unyielding, passionate, visionary, bold, influential, uncompromising, handsome, charismatic, opinionated, and articulate. He became a circuit-riding prophet, the environmental movement's conscience, who defined conservation and environmentalism from the mid-1950s until his death in 2000. He was an angry trailblazer, responsible more than any other for turning environmentalism from hiking and bird watching into a social and political force. Those same admirers also called Brower stubborn, contentious, controversial, irascible, impossible, polarizing, impolitic, impolite, and a notorious curmudgeon. He on occasion would willingly stretch facts into falsehoods, was so unwilling to tamp down his views that he destroyed lifelong friendships, and refused to take orders even from those in institutional positions above him. He was frustratingly independent. And yet he did all of this for one selfless reason: to sustain the Earth's natural environment. He wanted to save as much of the planet as possible from humans. He wanted to preserve what remained of the natural world and safely pass it to future generations. So I'm going to start here with a premise. And the premise is essentially that Brower was a risk taker, okay? And everything Brower did and everything Brower accomplished was based on the fact that he was willing to take these incredible gambles, these incredible risks. This picture says a little bit about Brower. He was born in Berkeley, California in 1912. Went to the University of California, did not graduate, and eventually found himself in the mountains, the Sierra Nevada mountains, and became kind of a world-class mountain climber. Did 33 first ascents just in the Sierra Club alone. During World War II, he got married, and he began having children, and he wound up with four children. And he also began having, during World War II, he began having affairs with men. He was bisexual for the rest of his life. He was fired from one of the jobs he had in 1952 because he propositioned a man. He would often proposition men within who he worked with in the Sierra Club. And in 1969, one of his enemies tried to fire him by accusing him of being a homosexual, which was a bad thing in that person's mind. He did this, and like I said, this was all a secret. It really never really came out, even though it was widespread, well, and known. And there was a reason it was a secret. Until very, very recently, you could not be a leader in this country. You could not lead the environmental movement the way David Brower did if he was a homosexual. It just would not have been accepted. And you know, I think to a certain extent this shows a strait that I found as I was doing the research on this book, that David Brower was willing to take these incredible gambles, to be able to hold on to the family, be able to hold on to his image, at the same time engaging in what he physically felt he had to do. So let's take a look at Brower and some of the things he accomplished, and then some of the things that started to get him in trouble. One of the things Brower did was he saved great places for all of us. It begins here at Dinosaur National Monument, which is on the Utah-Colorado border. And in the early 1950s, the government wanted to build two dams here, and they wanted to essentially do things like bury Steamboat Rock here, which is about 900 feet high, and about two-thirds of it was going to be covered by water. There are beautiful, beautiful canyons in Dinosaur, but these two dams were really going to bury them. The conservation movement was not like today's environmental movement. Environmental movement today has, you know, there's a whole bunch of organizations, one of which is the Sierra Club, which I believe some of you belong to, with million-dollar budgets. Literally, Sierra Club has more than a million members, big staffs. In those days, What we're talking about for the conservation movement is like garden clubs and the Audubon and the Sierra Club is very, very tiny. And so nobody really expected the conservationists to win this fight. But Brower went up and essentially was the leader in the fight and accomplished what was the impossible. He got the dams essentially to be pulled from the table, and they were never built. If you go to Dinosaur today, you'll find a plaque out there crediting Brower with what he did. You're familiar with the North Cascades. It's right in your backyard. Brower was involved in the fight, which really had begun early in the 20th century. There were a movement to try and do it. But Brower, skillfully using films, books, and other public relations campaigns, was part of the movement which essentially saved the North Cascades and made them a national park in 1968. The Redwoods was another fight where he was able to save it. Redwoods are one of the great, great trees out there in the world. At one point, there were 2 million acres of redwoods on the California coast. That was in 1850. By 1968, 90% of the old growth redwoods were gone. These trees are the tallest trees on earth. They live 500 to 700 years. Some live 2,000 years. And there was a massive campaign that Brower was involved in, which was only semi-successful because the logging industry was very powerful. And ultimately, like I said, we've lost a lot of the old growth. And if you go to the Redwoods, it is a park, but you will find the massive old growth redwoods, but you'll find a lot of smaller ones. He was also heavily involved in Yosemite from the time he was very young until the year he died in 2000, trying to save Yosemite. I won't go into too much detail about that. And perhaps as far as great places, this is probably the most important thing Brower was involved in with a number of other environmentalists. He helped push through what was called the Wilderness Act in 1964, which essentially established the principle that there will be land in America that will be set aside and preserved literally forever. At the time the act was passed in 1964, there were only 54 locations. That's now grown to 759 wilderness areas that have been identified, and 110 million acres, which is larger than California. So he's done some great things. Brower's other big contribution was in the book publishing industry, and it began with his friend Ansel Adams. In the late 1950s, Ansel Adams put an exhibit together called This is American Earth, and Adams talked to Brower about making it into a book. So Brower goes to the book publishing industry and talks to them and says, is it feasible? They said, no, no, no. When Brower describes what he wants to do, a very, very high-quality book. They just said it couldn't be done, it would be too expensive, they would have to cut costs, and because it was going to be expensive. It was going to be the equivalent, these books, of $200 to $250 for each one. So Brower went back and talked to the Sierra Club, and Adams was on the board of directors, and they decided to do it on their own. And they would produce these series of what are called exhibit format books, working with Ansel Adams, another photographer, Cedric Wright, and in particular, working with Elliot Porter. I want to read just a couple pages from the book because it's so fascinating what they were able to accomplish. In 1950, Elliot Porter's wife suggested that Porter do a book on Henry David Thoreau. Your pictures remind me so much of him, she told Porter. They show his Walden as it is. No one was more qualified than Porter, who 10 years earlier had given up a career in medicine and research at Harvard to take photographs of nature. What catapulted Porter's reputation, bringing Brower and the Sierra Club books along for the ride, was the color Porter could achieve. His chemistry background enabled him in his own darkroom to experiment with Eastman Kodak Company's new Kodachrome film at a time when other photographers shunned it. Porter spent years experimenting, but the result was clear, crisp color transparencies that dazzled. They pushed Porter to the forefront of photography as the popularity of color surged and that of black and white waned. It took Porter 10 years to finish the Thoreau book, and the expense of printing it scared publishers until it got to Brouwer. The beauty of the proposed book overwhelmed Brouwer, and he told Porter in a letter in February 1961 he would be willing to give up a lot, he would give a life of crime to pay for its publication. He knew he would need lots of cash to undertake the book, and he finally convinced a local businessman, Kenneth Bechtel, to provide $50,000 in loans and grants to subsidize the book. Bechtel was an interesting choice. His family owned an engineering and construction company based in San Francisco that was well known for building oil refineries, power plants, and facilities. In later years, Brouwer would rail against such projects. The next challenge was to find a printer capable of reproducing Porter's superb color photographs. It took months before Barnes Press of New York passed muster on the samples it showed to Brouwer and Porter. Barnes needed to produce 10,000 copies of Porter's 72 color prints and to get the four colors to balance and register on the presses. The firm used a 16-plate form with four rows of four, each of a different photographic image. The yellows, reds, blues, and blacks had to be matched perfectly in trial runs, with paper spewing off the presses. These experimental runs took an inordinate amount of time and often forced another trial. Brouwer recalled one evening when he stayed to supervise, while Porter and the owner of the press, Hugh Barnes, went to dinner around 7. Barnes returned at 9, Brouwer stayed until 11 and returned to his hotel. Porter, who'd slept after dinner, returned at 1 and stayed until dawn. This kind of pattern was not unusual at Barnes, and Brouwer's journal for years in the 1960s was filled with entries of his returning to the printer company at odd hours of the day or night. Finally, on a day in August 1962, Brouwer, Porter, Barnes, and others gathered around press number 3 and watched the first 2,500 sheets roll off the presses. The men examined them at a table using lenses carefully. "They were excellent," recalled Brouwer, "but they were not perfect." Hugh Barnes agreed. "How about it, Dave? Shall we throw out the first 2,500 sheets, and will you go 50-50 with me on the cost of the paper?" "How much would that cost?" Barnes said $200 for each of them. For Brouwer, that was the equal to the amount of dues the club got in a year from 25 members, but he agreed. Barnes returned a few minutes later. "You did the right thing," he said. "Now they," meaning the Barnes workers, "really know that this is a fussy job." Even though this book would be sold at an incredibly expensive $25, the equivalent of nearly $200 50 years later, the first 5,000 books of In Wildness is the Preservation of the World quickly sold out, as did the next 9 reprints. Critics praised the book. Only a bold photographer could try to capture Thoreau's vision again and again, but Mr. Porter succeeds triumphantly, declared the Christian Science Monitor. Brouwer was now the darling of publishing, the upstart who had proven that the commercial publishers were wrong. He had created a new genre, an expensive, sprawling book that openly touted an environmental message. The glossy books with the bold, beautiful photographs could have a hypnotic effect. John Mitchell, who would one day become editor of Sierra Club Books, recalled a friend who came into his office and waited while Mitchell finished an annoyingly long telephone call. Bored, the friend began to thumb through Porter's Wildness book. Mitchell's call finally ended. He remembered slamming down the door, the phone, to get the friend's attention. No response. It seemed nothing less than a cannon shot could have shaken his concentration, said Mitchell. This was not an unusual response. Time after time, people described how they joined the environmental movement and the Sierra Club by first browsing through an exhibit format book in a bookstore or a friend's house. These books were really incredibly, incredibly important to the Sierra Club, and they brought in tremendous numbers of people. They were absolutely beautiful books. They praised nature. They were campaign books for the Redwoods, for the Grand Canyon, for other projects. And they helped really grow the Sierra Club. When Brower joined the Sierra Club in January 1953, it had about 6,500 members. It had a circulation, not a circulation, I'm a newspaper guy. It had a membership base of 6,500 people. When he left in 1969, it had a budget of $3 million and about 80,000 members. And a lot of it was the books. Eventually, the paperback book publishing company discovered the books, and literally the paperbacks came out, and literally they sold millions with this lower price. So, like I said, Brower was a risk taker, and he was able to accomplish a great deal. He was able to save great places. He was able to convincingly use media in unique ways to promote nature, and he had built the Sierra Club into a national force. However, when you take risks, you're gambling. You're not always going to win. And what I discovered was that even though he was incredibly successful, incredibly dynamic, incredibly influential in what happened in the environmental movement, there were handicaps, there were problems that began to develop, and I'd like to talk about these for just a moment. He became increasingly unyielding. His concept of compromise began to disappear. His argument was you can't really compromise in saving natural resources, but there were consequences to pay for that. As he became more unyielding, he took less and less notice of the finances, and that created problems. And his independence eventually began to jeopardize his friendships, his relationships, and verged, if did not result in insubordination in working with people at the Sierra Club. So let's talk first about the compromise issue. David Brower believed strongly when he came to the Sierra Club in 1952 that compromise was essential for an environmental organization, that you really just could not succeed politically out there unless you worked with the other side and at times was willing to give in. And that's what he did at Dinosaur. He gave in at a place called Glen Canyon, which is in southern Utah, north of the Grand Canyon. Many of you are familiar with Glen Canyon. It's not clear how much Brower knew about what he was giving up with Glen Canyon, but here's a few photographs taken from the book, which is right here also, about the unbelievable geologic formations and sites that were out there. These come from Porter's book. They were all these places were eventually buried by this dam. It had a profound impact on Brower. He became increasingly bitter and increasingly angry, and he would make the rest of his career arguing that this dam should be removed. Interestingly, with the drought we have going on and with the fall of both Lake Powell and Lake Mead, may still happen. But it also became an incredibly popular place. There's some like 3 million visitors that go to Lake Powell every year. Bottom line is, he did not want to compromise as the years went by. The books were expensive, and the Sierra Club had to find a way to essentially finance them, and they were really self-financing them. They were becoming a publishing company at the time, and they were bringing in so many new members, they were bringing in so much revenue that it didn't matter for a while, but over the years, and the first book came out in 1960, the Ansel Adams book. The last book came out under Brower in 1968. The Sierra Club began to develop deficits. And this began to worry people. It began to worry people like Ansel Adams, who had known Brower since the 1930s, who'd had a father-son relationship with him. Brower always felt that it really wasn't his job to balance the books. It was his job to spend the money. And he would tell people that a really good environmental organization can't succeed unless it's always running in the red. Not a lot of financial people or even environmentalists today really agree with that viewpoint. He also would argue that the deficits and the financial problems that were coming out of the books were really over-dramatized, that were accounting tricks being played to make the books look worse than they really were. Everything was going along fine until they produced a book that would be a turkey. And then you were going to have problems as far as the finances. And towards the end, we have a book here, the Central Park book, did not do very well, and the deficit really soared. I found other evidence of Brower's financial irresponsibility. You know, some of this is painful because I really admire the guy and think he was great. But later on, he would run Friends of the Earth. And one of the ways he ran Friends of the Earth was he essentially started a campaign to borrow from his friends and supporters. And he was really struggling to keep the organization alive. Now, it's not unusual to make appeals for contributions, but it's almost unheard of for a nonprofit or a philanthropic organization to essentially appeal to its supporters, its loyal people, or its membership, and ask them for a loan of $500 or $1,000 or $2,000. But people did respond. They believed in Brower. They believed in the mission. And they did it. However, the financial problems only just increased over the years for Friends of the Earth. Ultimately, there were hundreds of people who were never paid back. They gave money, but they were not really loans. They were really contributions, and they were not disguised. They were not identified that way at all. Finally, there's the issue of his relationship with the board of directors of the Sierra Club, which would eventually deteriorate as the 1960s went on. And as the fights got tougher and the stakes got greater. A lot of it culminated, I mean, there's several aspects of what happened, and I won't get into all of them. I'll just zero in on one. And that essentially was the Grand Canyon, which was probably Brower's greatest fight and Brower's greatest victory. Just like Dinosaur, just like Glen Canyon, the federal government wanted to build dams, and they wanted to build dams in the Grand Canyon. Today, looking back, and it's more than 50 years now, it's just almost incomprehensible that anybody would want to build a dam in the Grand Canyon. But plans had been going on from the early 20th century. The dam builders had been trying to do it. One was in Marble Canyon, a beautiful area. The other was in Bridge Canyon. For a while, the fight didn't go very well. Brower really took over the campaign in the early 1960s and headed it. But people, for some reason, with Dinosaur, with the Redwoods, even with the North Cascades, and even Wilderness, he was able to get public attention. For a while, he had great difficulty. People just were not tuned in to the idea that the Grand Canyon was in danger. Slowly, that began to change. But the most brilliant move was when he started to run a series of newspaper advertisements. Okay? Full-page newspaper advertisements. This one being, should we also flood the Sistine Chapel so we can see it that much, see the ceiling easier? They were effective, but here's what really, really was effective. The opponents were really angry with these ads. The day after the first ad ran, The Internal Revenue Service, an agent for the Internal Revenue Service, went to the door of the Sierra Club's offices in San Francisco and gave them a document. And the document said that the Sierra Club was under investigation now by the IRS because it appeared to be engaged as a tax-deductible, non-profit, barred from political advertising or political lobbying. It was under investigation for doing exactly that, for engaging in political activism. Brower was in New York at the time and got the message, and he knew exactly what to say because Brower was brilliant when it came to media messages. He said, "The government's trying to censor the Sierra Club. The government is so angry with us that they'll do anything to shut us down because we are the great voice of environmentalism, which is trying to stop this terrible travesty in the Grand Canyon." And you talk about getting public attention. Suddenly everybody knew what was going on in the Grand Canyon. And absolutely, I mean, who likes the IRS? Who likes the tax man? It was brilliant, brilliant strategy. And within months, after struggling for years to accomplish this, Brower had gotten both dams killed. I mean, it would take another 2 years legislatively to do it, but he got them done. And a lot of it had to do with these ads. However, there were consequences to this because, frankly, the Sierra Club was guilty of engaging in political activism. Okay, I mean, it's true, and they knew it, and they'd known for years that they were just skirting on the edge. So they hired a lawyer, and they decided to fight it to see what they could. The lawyer suggested that they go a low-key, low-cost administrative route, challenging administratively and suggesting that, well, you know, we engage in political activity, but we do all this other stuff involving recreation and other things. Brower was bitterly, bitterly opposed to this. Now, Brower always thought big, and he thought expensively. He wanted to have this massive First Amendment fight against the IRS and get the law changed and get the legislature, get the Congress, or get the president, get the courts, somebody to change it and make a big deal about it. The board told him, "No, we hired this lawyer. He's a good tax lawyer. Let's go that route." So after the appeal is filed, the tax lawyer is asked to come to Washington to make his case, and he does. Brower keeps asking the board if he can come with the tax lawyer and also make his argument. And the board keeps saying, "No, you can't do this." So the lawyer makes his argument, goes to lunch, and gets a phone call while he's out to lunch from somebody at the IRS saying, "You know, we got this really funny telegram from this guy David Brower, and maybe you better come back and look at it and explain what's going on here." So the tax lawyer, a guy named Gary Torres, comes back and takes a look at the telegram. And essentially there, Brower has sent a very long, long telegram which explains in great detail Brower's legal position on this, which contradicts what the tax lawyer has said, okay? And it says, while the tax lawyer is well-meaning, he really hasn't represented the full picture here. And not only did Brower send this telegram to the IRS, he sent it to members of Congress, he sent it to the president. He sent it, there was a list of like 47 other people he sent it to, including other environmental organizations, trying to argue for a forum or something to get this started to get his position. Well, the lawyer was furious. He felt he'd been libeled, he thought he'd been undercut, and he had to go to the board, and the board had to agree with him, and they had to reprimand Brower, and they had to explain. Ultimately, the Sierra Club did lose this case, and for years they were hobbled by the restrictions that they had. They still did political lobbying and political activism, but they had to do it through a kind of circuitous route is what they had to do. That's kind of an example of the sort of difficulties Brower was having by the late 1960s with the Sierra Club. They were concerned about the finances. They were worried that the deficits were growing so big that the club might not be able to sustain them. They were concerned that they would give Brower orders and Brower would do exactly the same thing. It all climaxed in 1969 with a very bitter fight between Brower and the board, between Ansel Adams, pictured here, and David Brower, two lifelong friends who clashed. It's often been portrayed as a clash between conservatives and liberals, between people who, you know, wanted to be cautious in protecting the environment, and people like Brower who were fairly radical. The problem with that portrayal is it's just a little bit too simple. It's just a little bit too black and white. Brower was a much more complicated person than that. So I'll stop in just a moment. And we can have some questions. Just want to make two other points. It's really unfortunate that this conflict, which Brower was going to lose in 69, happened, because first of all, Brower had incredible talents, was an incredible visionary, and 1969, 1970 was a pivotal moment in what we now call the environmental movement. Earth Day was about to happen. The very first Earth Day was about to happen. Creation of the EPA, the creation of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and other legislation, and then just the rise of people who were concerned about the environment. It all happened beginning in 1970. And we had this great, great voice who had lost his position of power with the Sierra Club. And he was down there trying to reorganize and start a whole new organization, Friends of the Earth, which he scrambled on and worked on for years. And it's just unfortunate, and I've often wondered as I was doing this book, what would have happened if Brower just could have worked a little bit more with the board? He could have understood the finances a little, well, not understood, just kind of agreed to them a little bit more. And we could have really had a great leader. The other thing is, I think that's what's lacking today, is that we have, while the environmental organizations are probably stronger than ever, we have this great problem called climate change, and we need really bold, striking leaders, people who are able to take big risks. And we have essentially CEOs running organizations, and I think we need somebody who is just a little bit, crazier than that, to handle this crazy situation in this crazy world. Brower would go on after 1969 and be the sage of the environmental movement and campaign for many years. Some people would listen to him and some people wouldn't. And he died in, like, the day after the election in November 2000, after voting. Do you think he voted for Al Gore? Voted for Ralph Nader. All just very, very typical David Brower. And I'll leave you with this thought. David Brower always said, environmentalists make terrible neighbors, but great ancestors. Thank you. So I tried to not talk too long. If anybody has a question, yes. Brower was based in San Francisco. He was born in Berkeley. He lived in the Bay Area all of his life. There was an effort at one point. There were various efforts to try and fire Brower or to move him from some of the power. And at one point, there, because he was so effective with the publishing industry and he was spending almost 6 months of each year in New York, there was a movement to try and get him to go and have the Sierra Club have a New York office, that he would run the publishing aspect. And he said no, he was a San Francisco boy and he was going to be there all his life, and he was. So that's where he was from. The question was, where was David Brower based? I forgot to repeat the question. Yes. Did David Brower ever mellow out over years? No, if anything, he got crankier and more of an advocate than ever. I mean, he never really toned down at all. He was eventually elected to the Sierra Club Board of Directors in the 90s. I don't think it was the 80s. He might have been the first time in the 80s. And there was the John Muir Sierrans, I think was the name of the group, that was a splinter group within the Sierra Club at that time. And Brower was kind of a key member of it. And he was the radical. I mean, the Glen Canyon thing, he argued for years that Glen Canyon should, the government, I don't know how many hundreds of millions of dollars the government spent building that dam, but he wanted it torn down. Of course, other people did too. So no, he never mellowed out. Anybody else, or I'll take another question. Sure. Is it really feasible to dismantle Glen Canyon Dam? Well, you know, up until a few years ago, it's most people in power have not treated this seriously. But, you know, the drought and climate change are having an impact on public policy and water policy in the West. I think people are starting to look at it a little more seriously because of what's going on. Both those dams, both Lake Mead and Lake Dam, are way down. But of course, in some respects, people would argue, well, we need the water that's in those reservoirs more than ever. So it's not going to be easy if they ever do it. Could one of them be mothballed? I suppose one of them could be mothballed. But the idea has not been taken very seriously by most people in power, but anything is possible. Okay, well, if there's no other questions, we do have books over here. And even if you don't want a book, I brought some nice little postcards that have the cover of the book and a little remembrance, and you can have those too. So I want to thank you very much for this great reception.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.